minute later, Sean walks in the door with a grocery bag full of things. Mary takes the bag from him and says, "Well, if you want some real food, I might as well do the honors." She looks inside the bag and then at Jay. "I don't suppose you can cook or anything. I got a USB coffee mug warmer. Does that count?" "Yeah, she once tried to cook supper on it. Nearly killed me and the laptop both," says Mike. "What do you live on?" Mikey does the cooking. "I put up with it so long as it keeps him out of my hair. So let him help, but personally, I don't think he's very good at it." "You must be a joy to live with," says Mary. "Okay, then I guess it's up to me. Looks like it's going to be stir-fry. Give me a minute and I'll give you a hand." Despite what the girl with the tasty bake USB socket says, "I can boil water, which is more than she can do, I might add," says Mike. "Oh, look, I see there's an internet special on stomach pumps. Should I order one or two?" says Jay. "Okay, keep that up and you're back on the beef jerky, Twinkie, and caffeine diet you were on when we met. One more remark from you and your sex life will be back to beef jerky, if you know what I mean," says Jay menacingly. Mike gives her a sour look. David stifles a laugh. Mary laughs and rolls her eyes and says, "Davy, honey, I'm gonna like her." She turns and heads towards the kitchen. Time, 2 p.m. The apartment door swings open. Todd returns and says, "Okay, guys, how are things at Fort Shea? I suppose you've noticed our little company up Howard Street. Well, outside the door, we got four more. Look at cams 5, 18, 27, and 32. David brings up windows with camera views. In each shot, they see a van or a car. In each, a punk with a camera. Mike walks over to the display and looks carefully at each, then turns and says, "Can't we zap them with one of Todd's lasers or something? Actually, they're not doing anything illegal, and shooting them with a high-jewel ray gun might be construed as an unprovoked assault in some quarters. Anyway, too much wind-blown snow between here and their cars. It would scatter the beams," says Todd. "So you've tried this before?" asks Mike. "Oh, a few low-power experiments, perhaps," says Todd. Lance never noticed the paint blisters on his SUV. "I'll keep that in mind. Anyway, lunch is about ready." Time, 2:30 p.m. They sit around the big table eating. The master display now features a news channel feed. After a while, David turns and says to Todd, "You think they've finished at Pete's hotel yet?" "Probably. I'll check." He pulls out his cell phone and makes a call. Connects to one of the guys he sent to the hotel. He asks how things are going. He nods and says, "Okay," a few times, then says, "Yep, catch you later," then folds the phone and slips it back in his pocket. "They're finished. Piece of cake. We're in." Pete went downstairs and got lunch right after they got there, and they were able to slip in while he was out. They planted a couple of audio transponders and reprogrammed his laptop with some patches so the webcam will relay video back here. We'll also be able to capture the laptop screen as well as read his files. We've also hacked the hotel router so we can copy all his TCP/IP wireless traffic. "Neat, but how do you get the audio from the bugs back here?" says Jay. "Oh, they're Wi-Fi enabled. They're sending on the hotel wireless net," says Todd. "I've also got a Wi-Fi tap on the room's landline. I still don't have his cell phone. When I get it, I'll put a virus on it. Anyway, bottom line, we have his room covered for sound and video, and we own his laptop." Mike says, "Assuming I understood any of that, what happens when he shuts the laptop off?" "Nothing. We sort of installed a rootkit on it. Even when he thinks the machine is off, we've got control. When he powers down, my software shuts the screen off, spins down the disk, and switches off the status light so it looks like it's off. But it will continue to transmit pictures and sound from the built-in webcam and microphone. Here, I'll show you. It should be working now." Todd leans over, pulls out a keyboard and a mouse tray from the table, and clicks an icon on the main display. This opens a fisheye view of Pete's room. Pete is not visible, but Todd turns up the sound, and they can hear an electric shaver in the distance and the announcer on a TV news program. "Not bad. Not bad indeed. A little spyware goes a long way," says David. "I've also got his email listing with Jay's passwords and beginning to map the network he uses for conferencing and communications." "Don't you just love technology?" says Mike. "Makes you feel so safe and secure. Also, I'm sending out viruses to all the people in his email address book. The messages will install my spyware, then email me back here. Then the viruses will propagate to their address books and so on. I should be getting confirmation from my little bots in no time." "Won't that get like half the country after a few iterations?" asks Mike. "Yeah, we would, normally. 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon sort of thing. But as they send back the addresses they've invaded, after the first three iterations, my software will start matching up the lists and only go to sites that appear in multiple address books from the first three levels. It will send kill signals to the others. I'll also do some Bayesian analysis on the emails stored on the target machines and look for recurring patterns that suggest drug or crime-related activity. The ones that show positive will harvest their addresses, too. Won't people notice? What about those firewall things? Once we're in, and we've got a few unpublished email exploits of our own, my virus code also installs a rootkit." "Jeez, this is getting thick. And a rootkit is? This is about gardening, right?" asks Mike. "Well, harvesting, anyway. It's software that installs itself in the kernel of the operating system and can't be detected by any normal spyware scan, answers David. Tricky? Says Mike, confused. Todd turns down the sound, saying, very tricky, man. Okay, I'm switching over to sound monitor mode. If there's any sudden change in the ambient audio level, like new voices, phone ringing, the speaker will automatically turn up again. In the meantime, however, I'll leave the picture up. Do we know anything about the room he's in? Mike asks. Oh, yeah. Here's an email from one of the guys who went in there. It says Pete's laptop is on a desk against the wall on one side of the room. To its right, there's a balcony overlooking the hotel atrium. Very swank. Across the room from the desk, there's a small sitting area, two chairs, small couch, coffee table, and a couple of tables with lamps. A wall divider separates the bedroom area from the sitting room. Pete's room is on the top floor where all the luxury suites are, each with a balcony overlooking the atrium. On lower levels, a corridor and a railing run around the interior, and there's an exposed bank of glass cage elevators at one end. The whole thing is about 10 stories high. The lobby is divided into a reception area, a sitting area, and a dining room with dividers of plants, water fountains, that sort of thing. The roof of the atrium is all glass skylights. Here's some digital photos, as he brings up several shots of Pete's room. Sounds nice, Mike said. The drug trade pays well. I don't know. Nothing but the best for the lads that corrupt our youth. What? You mean public school teachers get luxury hotel suites too? Says Jay. Ignore her. She's from New Hampshire. They all ride around pickups with gun racks listening to Rush Limbaugh all day. No, unfortunately he's not on all day. Just 3 hours. Then we listen to Sean Hannity and tape replays. And what's wrong with a rifle in your truck? Everyone should be armed. Discourages the riffraff. You're dangerous, Jay. When the revolution comes, you're going to be one of the first up against the wall, says Mike. Mush for brains, liberal. May I remind you that when the revolution comes, we'll be the ones with the guns? I give up, says Mike in an exasperated tone. Jay ignores him and says, my impending demise at the hands of a cadre of neo-Maoist thought police notwithstanding. Maybe I'd better erase the record of your guy's keycard entry into Pete's room from the hotel database. No sense leaving any tracks, as she leans over her laptop and begins typing. Good idea. We need to remember little things like that. It's nice to have Jay here to remind us that you never can be too paranoid, says Mike. Are you sure she wasn't a cat burglar or something before you met her? Mary says, getting up, well then, it sounds like intermission. So it's my turn. You, pointing at Jay. You're coming with me. We'll see if we can fix you up a bit. Jay looks around at the others who are grinning. Mike says, you gotta go. Resistance is futile, dude. No, I'm too young to die. Save me. Somebody save me, says Jay in a melodramatic Theta Bara pose, palm upwards across her forehead. Nope, it's your turn. Face it like a geek. You know, whine incessantly, throw a tantrum, hide in the corner curled up in the fetal position, and wail uncontrollably. The usual. I only do that when you want to get romantic, says Jay as she reluctantly gets up and glares sternly at them, and then, a bit fearfully, at Mary, who grabs her by the shirt sleeve and drags her forcibly out of David's apartment to the makeover event. Time, 5 p.m. Todd, Mike, Lance, and David reassembles in David's apartment to go over their strategy. Jay makes a late appearance and mutters a lot of epithets, especially concerning a certain sadist named Mary and the amount of bling that's on order with overnight delivery. Mary follows her in. Jay is sporting a new silky pink blouse, designer pants, a gold chain belt, new shoes, along with several heavy gold chain necklaces, bracelets, and earrings. Hey, Mike, Jay's a girl. Did you know that? Says Todd, noting Jay's new attire. Yeah, and the next one who makes a remark is going to be a gelding, Jay spits out with ferocity. You better keep your mouth shut, guys. I think she means it, says Mike. No, she's all right. She calmed down a bit when we decided that laptop accessories were really fashion statements, sorta, says Mary. What? What have you ordered now, says David. Nothing much, honey. We found a nice techie shopping channel. Just some things called USB drives, flash drives, power supplies with matching lithium-ion batteries, memory add-ons, and a couple of nice colored coordinated Prada bags. Oh, geez, how much? We lost count. The bags were a bargain, though. Not much more than $1,000 each. What? Like you can't afford it? So, have there been any developments since my involuntary incarceration? Asks Jay. Todd looks around at the others and say, not much. It looks like we're going to have some company again tonight. David says, sure does, but at least we know who. Have we printed out copies of their mugshots? You bet. Nice and clear. They're already printed downstairs. I'll be sure everyone has a copy and keeps close watch on them. I'll keep a security camera on them too, says Lance. What about them cutting the power? Is no one worried about the fact that they're going to shut the lights out with the place full of people and set off smoke bombs and light gasoline? Asks Mike. No, say the others in unison. Okay, humor me. Why not? Generally, I'd consider it a problem. I got two gas-fired JT9D-3As hooked up to a motor generator in the basement, says David. Okay, I didn't understand any of that, as usual. We don't run off the mains, Mike. The electricity coming in here runs an electric motor that spins a big flywheel that turns a generator. That way we get much cleaner electricity. No spikes or surges, says Todd. And we have two Pratt & Whitney jet engines hooked on the drive shaft. The power cuts out, one of the engines is online in less than a second. They each can generate 120,000 horsepower, enough to get a Boeing 747 off the ground, says Lance. They cut in automatically automatically and run on natural gas. They use the same emergency system for the Boston subways without the flywheel, says Todd. Both engines at full power can do a total of almost 180 megawatts. We could power half of Omaha if we wanted to, adds David. Oh, never mind. Sorry I ask. They're not noisy, are they? I never did like airplanes. Duh, yes. Ah, but we vent them out the old chimney anyway. With the racket down the dance floor, who'd notice, says David. Mike doesn't like noisy mechanical things except that lead sled of a car of his, offers Jay. Hey, watch what you say. That lead sled saved my life. Anyway, I like you, and geez, the noise I get from you. Oh, you love it. I'm the only one who takes you seriously.